Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, June 15th, 2025. We open with the New York Times trilobite, posted on February 17th, 2025, entitled, Hummingbirds Living in a Hive Found for the First Time. In a remote mountain cave in Ecuador, hummingbirds were discovered sleeping and nesting together. By Rachel Neuer. Hummingbirds are tiny and delicate, but don't be fooled. They are among the most aggressive birds in the avian kingdom. Their territorial furor is especially aimed at other hummingbirds. Competition over a patch of flowers or a mate often results in high-speed aerial chases, dive bombing, and beak jousting. So when Gustavo Cañas Valle, an ornithologist and birding guide, stumbled across a cave full of hummingbirds nesting and roosting together in Ecuador's high Andes, he could hardly believe it. I thought, this looks like a colony, Mr. Cañas Valle said. He added, they were like bees. He documented 23 adult birds and 4 chicks, all of the subspecies Oreotrochilus, Chimborazo, Chimborazo, commonly known as the Chimborazo Hill Star. Mr. Cañas Valle's discovery, described in the journal Ornithology in November 2024, may be the first documented example of hummingbirds that nested and roosted communally. It is also notable that he found the birds engaging in both these behaviors in the same space, something that even highly social species from other bird families tend not to do. Juan Luis Buzat, an evolutionary geneticist at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, and another author of the study, who is also Mr. Cañas Valle's former graduate advisor, said the finding raised fascinating questions about the role environmental factors can play in driving group living and in promoting the evolution of certain social traits. Dr. Buzat and Mr. Cañas Valle at first hypothesized that harsh environmental conditions along the Chimborazo volcano, where they found the nests, had forced the birds together. The birds live more than 12,000 feet above sea level on a sparsely vegetated slope where it is hard to come by nectar-providing flowers, water, or shelter from freezing temperatures and biting winds. Either you aggregate or perish, Dr. Buzat said. But this may not be the full story. Mr. Cañas Valle explored the region and found 6 other examples of hummingbirds nesting and roosting together. He and Dr. Buzat also surveyed concrete drainage pipes scattered around the area. The pipes had similar environmental conditions to the cave, but could fit only 1 or 2 nests. The researchers found that just 45% of the pipes were occupied by nesting females, significantly lower than the frequency expected by chance, according to computer simulations the authors conducted. There were significantly more nests found in groups, on the other hand, than there would have been if randomly predicted. Of the 74 total nests Mr. Cañas Valle documented, 82% were part of groups. Together, these findings implied that the birds were actively choosing group living over nesting alone. Dr. Buzat suspects that environmental factors originally caused the birds to aggregate, but that once they bunched together, they evolved traits that made them more social, helping them adapt to their environment. I was very surprised to read about a truly colonial hummingbird, because most are aggressive and intolerant of others of the same species, said Scott Robinson, an ornithologist at the Florida Museum of Natural History, who was not involved in the work. No one would have considered a hummingbird a candidate for coloniality. Charles Brown, a behavioral ecologist at the University of Tulsa, who also was not involved in the research, said he was not convinced, however, that the hummingbirds observed in the study actually qualified as being colonial. Animals that live in true colonies often behave in ways that benefit their neighbors, Dr. Brown said, such as working together to find food or detect predators. While it was interesting to find hummingbirds in close quarters, There was no evidence of any social behavior on the parts of the animals nesting in these clusters, he said. Mr. Cañas Valle pointed out, however, that he observed the hummingbirds from the cave departing and returning together, suggesting a cohesive social group. It's not that each one was doing their own thing, Dr. Buzat said. But the authors agree that more research is needed. They hope to conduct behavioral studies to determine if the hummingbirds are merely tolerating each other or are actively cooperating. They would also like to conduct surveys for other hummingbird species in similar high Andes environments to see if they are engaging in group living, too. I'm sure there are other unknown caves in the mountains where hummingbirds live, Mr. Cañas Valle said. I'm expecting to find other species for sure. Hummingbirds living in a hive found for the first time in a remote mountain cave in Ecuador. From Advances, in the September 2024 issue of Scientific American, in the Department of Tech, Gaming Gains. Action-packed video games advance word awareness. In the video game Space Invaders Extreme 2, a player has to fire weapons to obliterate aliens attacking Earth. These extraterrestrials move fast, raining down from the top of the screen and claiming a player's life if they reach the bottom. A study in the journal Nature suggests such games may help children at risk for developmental dyslexia, a genetic neurological condition that makes processing words difficult, by improving their ability to perceive spoken words and sounds. Destroying digital aliens might seem unrelated to distinguishing between words, but past research has shown that action video games, which a person needs swift cognitive and motor skills to master, activate attention-controlling parts of the brain that process memory. For the new study, 79 pre-reading children with family histories of dyslexia took several language tests, including listening for differences in made-up words, a task that can be challenging for dyslexic people. The kids were then split into four groups. One played Space Invaders Extreme 2, a second played a non-action video game, a third attended speech therapy, the usual treatment for language disorders in Italy, where the study took place, and a fourth received no intervention. Games played four times a week for 45 minutes each over a month and a half, and those in speech therapy attended 45-minute sessions twice weekly over about 4 months. By the end of the trial, more than 80% of the Space Invaders players were significantly better at word identification tasks than before, and they showed greater improvements than any of the other three groups. The researchers aren't sure why games boosted this specific task. Scores on the other language tests did not improve notably, but they say that this finding could be valuable. If we can target these small cognitive functions before children are older and lose some brain plasticity, then perhaps we can treat aspects of dyslexia before they've fully formed, says study co-author Simone Gori, a neuroscientist at the University of Bergamo in Italy. Dyslexia often goes untreated in Italy's overburdened public health and school systems, says Marilu Gorno-Tempini, a behavioral neurologist at the University of California, San Francisco, who is from Italy. She says this research offers promise for early childhood intervention, and she hopes to see larger future studies conducted in other languages as well. The new study is one of the first of what Kaiser Kaderi, a Stanford University neuro-ophthalmic surgeon, predicts will be managed to demonstrate that video games can help people with learning disorders. Eyes are an extension of the brain, he says. So when we play video games, it's directly connected to our cognitive function, and there is so much research potential there. This article, Gaming Gains, in Advances, Department of Tech, was written by Reese Williams. It appears in the September 2024 issue of Scientific American. Next, a series of articles from the October 5th, 2024 issue of Science News, all related to the issue of heat. The first one, Teaser, zigzag buildings could beat the heat. Adding zigzags to walls could help cool buildings by reflecting more of the sun's energy. A new corrugated design can reduce daily average exterior wall temperatures by a couple of degrees Celsius, materials scientist Yuan Yang of Columbia University and colleagues report in the September 17th issue of the journal Nexus. Downward facets coated with reflective materials and upward facets coated with emissive ones help the wall absorb less heat than straight walls. In a test of small-scale walls, the zigzag version was 2.3 degrees cooler on average than a conventional wall. The difference grew to 3.1 degrees during the hottest day of the year. This article posted by Carolyn Gramling. In the Department of Animals, heat may hamper bees' sense of smell. Antennae struggle to detect flowers' scents after a heat wave, by Gennaro Toma. Heat waves don't just make bumblebees hot. The high temperatures also seem to drastically reduce the insect's sense of smell, which might threaten the survival of colonies. For bumblebees, the ability to smell flowers is a matter of life or death. Olfactory cues help lead them to the best flowers to harvest nectar and pollen. But exposure to simulated heat waves reduced the ability of bumblebee antennae to detect flower scents by up to 80%, insect ecologist Sabine Newton and colleagues reported in the August issue of Proceedings of the Royal Society B. With climate change expected to increase the severity and frequency of heat waves, the animals need to find a way to adapt somehow to cope with this, says Newton of the University of Würzburg in Germany. Bumblebees are already suffering from climate change. A thick, furry body makes bumblebees well adapted to thrive in cold regions, but cold resistance in a warming world can turn fatal. Newton and colleagues wanted to understand whether heat waves could also impact the ability of bumblebees to smell flowers. The researchers exposed about 140 bees of two common species to simulated heat waves, placing the bees in tubes for almost 3 hours at temperatures up to 40 degrees Celsius. A subset of bees were placed in a dry environment. Some had access to sugary resources, and some were given time to recover at ambient temperatures for 24 hours after the heat treatment. Afterward, the researchers cut off all the bees' antennae, which the insects used to smell, and measured whether olfactory sensory neurons in the antennae could detect chemical compounds that give many flowers their scent. Heat waves reduced the strength of the neurons' electrical signals by up to 80%. Female worker bees were more affected than males. Even worse, the antennae of the bees that had 24 hours to cool off still hadn't fully recovered their sense of smell. That was surprising, Newton says. The team had expected those antennae to recover. The fact that they didn't suggests the bees didn't recover swiftly, which spells trouble for getting food for the colony, she says. The negative effect of heat waves on worker bumblebees' sense of smell could have a cascading effect on the survival of the whole colony, Newton hypothesizes. Together with other factors, such as habitat loss, it could be one explanation for why we see so many population declines, she says. Bumblebee ecologist Dave Golson of the University of Sussex in England notes that antennae morphology is quite similar across bee species. If bumblebees suffer in this way, I think it's probable that other bees would too, he says. But until someone looks, we won't know for sure. And news in brief, the Department of Climate. Dry spells give valley fever a boost. California droughts can keep cases of valley fever low, but cases skyrocket when the rain returns. Researchers analyzed cases of valley fever, a sometimes lethal illness caused by a fungi that spreads through dust, in California from 2000 to 2021. Cases tended to peak between September and November, the end of the dry season, the team reported in the October issue of Lancet Regional Health, Americas. Smaller peaks occurred during drought, but cases spiked a year or two after the dry spell ended. Why is unclear. Fungal populations might crash during droughts, helping surviving fungi thrive with less competition in wet times. A lack of rain may also boost amounts of spore-spreading dust. Knowing when the valley fever season starts can help doctors stay alert for cases, says Justin Remey, an environmental health researcher at the University of California, Berkeley. This news brief posted by Erin Garcia de Jesus. And these three articles on the effects of heat appear in the October 5th, 2024 issue of Science News. But wait, there's more. Also in this October 5th issue of Science News, how bizarre. Mayonnaise may shed light on nuclear fusion experiments. Mayonnaise's texture inspires love and loathing. Either way, it's perfect for physics experiments. The condiment's behavior sits on the border between elastic and plastic. If jiggled, mayo returns to its original shape. That's elastic behavior. But fling the condiment forcefully, and it goes plastic, meaning the mayo changes shape permanently or breaks apart. This elastic to plastic transition can also occur in experiments that use lasers to kick off nuclear fusion. The lasers blast a fuel-filled capsule, raising pressures and temperatures so high that atomic nuclei in the fuel fuse and release energy. The molten capsule has some properties of a solid. Like gloopy mayo, it doesn't flow on its own, but it can break apart under enough force. Because it's difficult to study how materials behave under the extreme conditions required for fusion, engineers Arindam Banerjee and Aaron Boyachi of Lehigh University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, turned to mayo. Accelerating the condiment into air using a rotating wheel revealed where the border between elastic and plastic is, the team reported in the May issue of Physical Review E. The mayo and air are akin to the molten fuel capsule and the gas it contains. If the capsule material becomes plastic before fusion occurs, the gas could escape, spoiling the fusion attempt. How Bizarre News Bit was written by Emily Conover. Next, from the New York Times, posted on October 19, 2024. Reinventing Concrete, the Ancient Roman Way. By learning the secrets of 2,000-year-old cement, researchers are trying to devise greener, more durable modern options. By Amos Zeeberg. In June, the Italian Ministry of Culture announced the excavation of a new room, not yet open to the public, in the ruins of Pompeii. A few weeks later, a group of archaeologists gathered to marvel at it. Walls covered with bright blue paint, an expensive pigment reserved for special rooms, and detailed frescoes of agricultural images, remarkably well preserved after almost 2,000 years. Admir Basich, a chemist at MIT, was more captivated by what appeared, to an unschooled guest, like an unremarkable pile of sandy dirt at the edge of the room. The material, light tan and granular, had been a critical component of the Roman Empire, he said, the precursor to concrete, a mainstay of Roman infrastructure, including the aqueducts that brought fresh water to cities like Pompeii. They managed to bring water to the city, and with water came hygiene, Dr. Masich said. That technological advance allowed them to, first of all, build Rome as it is, but also replicate this anywhere they would go. He spread his arms as if circumscribing the entire Roman world. Modern concrete, based on a material known as Portland cement, was developed in England in the 19th century and is the world's most popular building material by far. It is cheap, strong, and standardized. providing engineers everywhere with an easy material for building apartments, dams, skyscrapers, and more. But it is much less resilient than the concrete used in Roman times. Over the course of decades, it develops cracks that, by letting water in, can eventually destroy the material. Moreover, the manufacture of concrete is a major driver of climate change, producing 8% of carbon dioxide emissions worldwide. By learning these secrets of Roman concrete, researchers like Dr. Masich can try to devise greener, more durable, modern options. Roman marine concretes have survived in one of the most aggressive environments on Earth, with no maintenance at all, said Marie Jackson, a geologist at the University of Utah. A self-healing substance. Roman concrete derives much of its strength from a mixture of calcium aluminate, silicate, hydrates, known as CASH, C-A-S-H, with different chemical formulas. But exactly how the Romans produced that material is not clear. The traditional belief is that Romans heated limestone, mostly made of calcium carbonate, to produce a dangerously reactive material called quicklime or calcium oxide. Then they added water, forming calcium hydroxide or slaked lime. Finally, they combined this with a bulky material, often volcanic ash, which supplied the aluminum and silicon necessary for the concrete, the A and S in CASH. Dr. Masich sees a problem with this explanation. Many examples of Roman concrete, he noted, contain visible white chunks or clasts. You see these everywhere, in Rome, in Africa, in Israel, he said. The chunks are typically thought to be unintentional products of poor workmanship, but Dr. Masich maintains that Roman engineers were too clever to consistently make concrete riddled with mistakes. People said lime clasts are bad mixing of slaked lime, he said. Our hypothesis is it's not part of bad processing. It's part of the technology. According to Dr. Masich's research, these lime clasts were actually reservoirs of calcium that helped fill in cracks, making the concrete self-healing. As cracks formed, water would seep in and dissolve the calcium in the lime, which then formed solid calcium carbonate, essentially creating new rock that filled in the crack. Dr. Masich contends that the lime clasts came not from slaked lime, but from quicklime that Romans added directly, a process called hot mixing. Since quicklime is so reactive, it generates heat when combined with volcanic ash, warming the material to over 170 degrees Fahrenheit, making the concrete harden much faster. The technique also generated some hot spots of almost 400 degrees, causing some of the quicklime to remain in small, intact chunks. The clasts, seen in Roman concrete today, that provide its self-healing properties, Dr. Masich said. But it's hard to prove that the Romans intentionally left chunks of quicklime in their concrete, because the chunks changed chemically over the centuries. By examining the clasts with special microscopes, Dr. Masich said, he and his colleagues have shown that the clasts indeed started out as quicklime. Dr. Masich has spun off his research into a company called DMAT, which aims to integrate the principles of Roman concrete chemistry into the modern version. It sells an additive that claims to seal cracks in concrete, which in theory would reduce the reliance on Portland cement, with its big carbon footprint. We generate more strength, generate more binding agent, said Paolo Sabatini, the company's chief executive. When we do that, we use less concrete. Volcanic reactions. Not all researchers are convinced that hot mixing was the key to the Romans' self-healing concrete. Dr. Jackson contends, instead, that the secret lay in the bulky materials that were mixed with lime, often a type of volcanic ash called pozzolana. Named after the seaside town of Pozzuoli, Italy, where much of it was excavated, pozzolana activated special chemical reactions that lent Roman concrete its unmatched durability, according to her research. The initial reaction of lime and pozzolana generated the cache compounds that acted as the glue in ancient Roman concrete, and the materials continued reacting, forming rare minerals like stretlingite for many years after the concrete was made, Dr. Jackson found. The stretlingite crystals, shaped like flakes and needles, helped bond together rough chunks of material in the concrete. This toughening of the concrete seems to be critical to the long-term resilience, she said, and contributes to reinforcing cohesion over the centuries. Dr. Jackson and her collaborators have tested their hypotheses about ancient concrete by creating modern analogs of it. In one experiment, the researchers built concrete arches, submerged them in seawater for 50 days, and then pushed the top of the arches with increasing pressure until the concrete started to bend and crack. Then the arches were submerged for almost a year and tested again. The researchers found that cache compounds had filled the tiny cracks and that the arches could withstand 2 to 3 times as much force as before, depending on the particular test. Then the team submerged the arches once more. Later this month, they plan to test them again after almost 3 years in seawater. The way Romans chose the materials actually blocked the propagation of fractures, Dr. Jackson said. They were the masters. This New York Times article that highlights the research of Admir Masich and Marie Jackson, a geologist at the University of Utah, was posted on October 19, 2024, and written by Amos Zeeberg. Reinventing Concrete, the Ancient Roman Way. And now, the staggering success of vaccines. From Innovations in Solutions for Health Equity in the November 2024 issue of Scientific American, we look at why vaccines have been aiding health equity for 200 years and why today they are poised to save even more lives from more diseases. By Tara Hale. A May study in the journal Lancet estimated that vaccines against 14 common pathogens have saved 154 million lives over the past 5 decades, at a rate of 6 lives every minute. Vaccines have cut infant mortality by 40% globally and by more than 50% in Africa. Throughout history, vaccines have saved more lives than almost any other intervention, and vaccines' promotion of health equity goes far beyond preventing death. The Lancet study found that each life saved through immunization resulted in an average 66 years of full health without the long-term problems that many diseases cause. Vaccines play a role in nearly every measurement of health equity, from improving access to care to reducing disability and long-term morbidity to preventing loss of labor and the death of caretakers. We say vaccines are one of humanity's great achievements in terms of having furthered the lifespan and life quality for humanity in the past 50 years, says the chief program officer at Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, a public-private partnership that works to ensure low- and middle-income countries have access to vaccines against more than 20 infectious diseases. Every country in the world has an immunization program, thanks to the World Health Organization's Expanded Program on Immunization, or EPI, which was established in 1974. Every single country and territory has access to at least some vaccines, says Kate O'Brien, director of the WHO's Immunization, Vaccines, and Biologicals Department. Poverty, malnutrition, underlying health conditions, overcrowding, human conflict, displacement, and lack of access to medical care, hygiene, or sanitation All of these are risk factors for infectious disease, O'Brien says. Vaccines' ability to reduce disease in the settings most plagued by these problems gives them disproportionate power to improve equity. Millions and millions saved. The Essential Program on Immunization, developed in 1974 by the World Health Organization, with the goal of vaccinating children in every country against six diseases: diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, polio, measles, and a form of tuberculosis. In the 50 years since, it has grown to include immunization against seven additional infections: HIV, hepatitis B, rubella, pneumonia, rotavirus, human papilloma virus, or HPV, and for adults, COVID. Additionally, organizations such as Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, have run vaccination campaigns against other diseases, including malaria, Ebola, and cholera. The cumulative efforts to vaccinate the world over the past half a century have saved more lives than nearly any other health intervention to date. A study published in The Lancet calculated the global impact of worldwide vaccination by modeling the averted deaths that could have been caused by 14 major pathogens in 194 World Health Organization member states from 1974 to 2024, including most of those in the current EPI program. The magnitude of the results is striking, yet they still underestimate the true impact because the study did not include vaccines for COVID, influenza, HPV, malaria, Ebola, or several others known to reduce mortality. Even so, the authors found that the immunizations they did include have prevented 154 million deaths, 95% of which would have been of children under 5 years old. In some regions, vaccination cut infant mortality in half, and the measles vaccine had the greatest effect overall on keeping children alive. And the statistics: the total number of deaths averted globally because of vaccines between 1974 and 2024, a 50-year span for selected diseases. Measles, 93.7 million. Tetanus, 27.96 million. Pertussis, 13.1 million. Tuberculosis, 10.9 million. HIV, 2.8 million. Polio, 1.6 million. And other pathogens included in the study: diphtheria, hepatitis B, Japanese encephalitis, meningitis, rotavirus, rubella, pneumonia, and yellow fever, 3.7 million. And these are the total number of deaths averted globally because of vaccines over a 50-year span. Where vaccines matter most: the relative impact on mortality varies by country, depending on how affected that country already is by a particular disease and the other major causes of diseases there. Vaccine-preventable diseases cause far fewer deaths in high-income countries, where sanitation, hygiene, nutrition, medical infrastructure, and healthcare access have already substantially improved survival. Meanwhile, vaccines have an outsized impact on preventing deaths in low- and middle-income countries, where infectious disease remains a top killer. In short, as the Lancet study authors write, vaccines promote equity by saving more lives in places where more deaths occur. And this summary of the statistics showing the success, the staggering success of vaccines, comes from the November 2024 issue of Scientific American in a special section entitled Innovations in Solutions for Health Equity. On January 22, 2025, the BBC, British Broadcasting Service, posted a thrilling tale: giant iceberg on crash course with island, putting penguins and seals in danger. Climate and science reporter and data journalist Georgina Renard and Erwin Revolt collaborated on the story. The world's largest iceberg is on a collision course with a remote British island, potentially putting penguins and seals in danger. The iceberg is spinning northwards from Antarctica towards South Georgia, a rugged British territory and wildlife haven, where it could ground and smash into pieces. It is currently 173 miles away. Countless birds and seals died on South Georgia's icy coves and beaches when past giant icebergs stopped them feeding. Icebergs are inherently dangerous. I would be extraordinarily happy if it just completely missed us, Sea Captain Simon Wallace told the BBC News, speaking from the South Georgia government vessel, Pharos. And now, 2 days ago, the headline from BBC reads, "World's largest iceberg runs aground off remote island." Again, the same reporters, Georgina and Renard, and Erwin Revolt report. The world's largest iceberg has run aground in shallow waters off the remote British island of South Georgia, home to millions of penguins and seals. The iceberg, which is about twice the size of Greater London, appears to be stuck and should start breaking up on the island's southwest shores. Fishermen fear they will be forced to battle with vast chunks of ice, and it could affect some macaroni penguins feeding in the area. But scientists in Antarctica say that huge amounts of nutrients are locked inside the ice, and that as it melts, it could create an explosion of life in the ocean. The iceberg is called A23A. It's like dropping a nutrient bomb into the middle of an empty desert, says Professor Nadine Johnston from British Antarctic Survey. Ecologist Mark Belshear, who advises the South Georgia government, said, if it breaks up, the resulting icebergs are likely to present a hazard to vessels as they move in the local currents and could restrict vessels' access to local fishing grounds. The stranding is the latest twist in an almost 40-year story that began when the mega chunk of ice broke off the Filchner-Ron ice shelf in 1986. We have tracked its route on satellite pictures since December 2024, when it finally broke free after being trapped in an ocean vortex. As it moved north through warmer waters, nicknamed Iceberg Alley, it remained remarkably intact. For a few days, it even appeared to spin on the spot, before speeding up in mid-February, traveling at about 20 miles or 30 kilometers a day. The future of all icebergs is that they will die. It's very surprising to see that A23A has lasted this long and only lost about a quarter of its area, said Hugh Griffiths, speaking to BBC News from the Sir David Attenborough Polar Research Ship, currently in Antarctica. On Saturday, the 300-meter-tall ice colossus struck the shallow continental shelf about 50 miles or 80 kilometers from land and now appears to be firmly lodged. It's probably going to stay more or less where it is until chunks break off, says Professor Andrew Measures from British Antarctic Survey. It is showing advancing signs of decay. Once 1,500 square miles in size, it has been steadily shrinking, shedding huge amounts of water as it moves into warmer seas. It is now an estimated 3,234 square kilometers, which is slightly smaller than 1,500 square miles. Instead of a big, sheer, pristine box of ice, you can see caverns under the edges. Tides will be lifting it up and down, and where it is touching the continental shelf, it will grind backwards and forwards, eroding the rock and ice. If the ice underneath is rotten, eroded by salt, it'll crumble away under stress and maybe drift somewhere more shallow, says Professor Measures. But where the ice is touching the shelf, there are thousands of tiny creatures like coral, sea slugs, and sponge. Their entire universe is being bulldozed by a massive slab of ice scraping along the seafloor, says the professor. That is catastrophic in the short term for these species, but, he says, that it is a natural part of the life cycle in the region. Where it is destroying something in one place, it's providing nutrients and food in other places. And there is a graphic that shows where the iceberg calved from the Filchner ice shelf in 1986. It had been stuck on the seafloor for 30 years, and that was the point from which it traveled. It traveled south in 2022, and then in 2023, it made rapid progress along the seafloor ridge. In 2024, it began to rotate on a water column for 8 months, and then finally, its latest position on March 3rd, 2025, was right next to South Georgia Island. There had been fears for the island's larger creatures. In 2004, an iceberg in a different area called the Ross Sea affected the breeding success of penguins, leading to a spike in deaths. But experts now think that most of South Georgia's birds and animals will escape that fate. Some macaroni penguins that forage on the shelf where the iceberg is stuck could be affected, says Peter Fretwell at the British Antarctic Survey. The iceberg melts fresh water into salt water, reducing the amount of food, including krill, a small crustacean that penguins eat. The birds can move to other feeding grounds, he explains, but that would put them in competition with other creatures. The ice could block harbors or disrupt sailing when the fishing season starts in April. This will be the most ice from an iceberg we will have ever dealt with in a fishing season, but we are well prepared and resourced, says Andrew Newman from Argos Froyans. But scientists working in Antarctica currently are also discovering the incredible contributions that icebergs make to ocean life. Professor Griffiths and Professor Johnston are working on the Sir David Attenborough ship, collecting evidence of what their team believe is a huge flow of nutrients from ice in Antarctica across Earth. Particles and nutrients from around the world get trapped into the ice, which is then slowly released into the ocean, the scientists explain. Without ice, we wouldn't have these ecosystems. They are some of the most productive in the world and support huge numbers of species and individual animals, and feed the biggest animals in the world, like the blue whale, says Professor Griffiths. A sign that this nutrient release has started around A23A will be when vast phytoplankton blossom around the iceberg. It would look like a vast green halo around the ice, visible from satellite pictures over the next weeks and months. The life cycle of icebergs is a natural process, but climate change is expected to create more icebergs as Antarctica warms and becomes more unstable. More could break away from the continent's vast ice sheets and melt at quicker rates, disrupting patterns of wildlife and fishing in the region. This latest update on the progress of iceberg A23A was reported by the BBC on March 6, 2025. Next, the February 2025 issue of Science News recounts a different story of oceans and marine life. From Environment, in the news department, The Blob Killed Millions of Seabirds, by Jake Bueller. The tall, stony coastlines along the Northeast Pacific Ocean are much quieter than they were just a decade ago. Following a punishing marine heat wave in the region, the raucous seabird colonies that once crowded the sea cliffs are now greatly thinned to a quarter of their former size in some places. This abrupt loss of millions of birds may be the largest wildlife mortality event recorded in modern times, researchers reported in the journal Science. We knew the population decline was big, but the numbers are a gut punch, says Heather Renner, a wildlife biologist with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service at the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge in Homer. The story began in late 2014 when a brutal marine heat wave nicknamed the Blob parked itself over the Northeast Pacific, raising ocean temperatures far above normal for almost 2 years. The colossal cauldron cooked up an ecological chain reaction, slashing phytoplankton populations, and in turn, the fish that seabirds like common murres eat. In 2015 and 2016, the birds starved to death en masse. Renner runs a monitoring program spanning the region's coastline that has been collecting data on seabirds for the last 50 years. The scale of the toll was immediately obvious. "We knew right away that it was a big catastrophe," Renner says. "There were 62,000 carcasses that washed up on the beaches, all over the Gulf of Alaska, all the way down to California. It was clearly a big deal, but we couldn't really quantify the size of the mortality very well." To get a better idea of the full impact on the murre population, the team used colony count data from 1995 to 2022, gathered across 13 colonies along the coast and on islands in the Bering Sea and the Gulf of Alaska. After getting bird counts before and after the heat wave, the team then extrapolated those results to the entire Alaskan murre population. Renner and colleagues estimate that the heat wave killed 4 million murres in the Gulf of Alaska and eastern Bering Sea. About half of Alaska's murres died in a single winter. "It was just so much worse than we thought," Renner says. The loss is the largest die-off of wildlife, specifically non-fish vertebrates, yet reported in the modern era, the team suggests. In another heat wave a few years earlier, some 10 billion snow crabs in the Bering Sea died from starvation. The sheer scale and speed of the common murre population collapse is shocking, says ecologist Simon Tai of the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville. The before and after pictures of the colonies are pretty heartbreaking. The fact that the birds hadn't rebounded even 7 years later helps reject a hypothesis that the birds were just temporarily delaying breeding to wait out the hostile conditions. The stubbornly sparse colonies may mean that something fundamental has changed in the ecosystem and can't support a return to past murre numbers. Renner doesn't think climactic impacts spurring such a dramatic, swift shift have been previously documented. The findings show such intense changes can occur on the scale of years. Tai and Renner both point out that with continued climate warming, heat waves like the blob are expected to occur more frequently. This could imperil already vulnerable populations of many animals that have yet to recover from the previous heat wave. And this article, "The Blob Killed Millions of Seabirds," appears in the February 2025 issue of Science News. Continuing in this same issue, from the Department of Health and Medicine, the latest news, "What Science Says About Alcohol's Link to Cancer," by Amy Cunningham. In January, the U.S. Surgeon General released a report on the link between drinking alcohol and developing cancer. It may have surprised many people. Although evidence for this link has been growing for some time, less than half of Americans are aware of the association, according to a 2019 study. That's in contrast to tobacco, which 89% of the survey respondents identified as a cancer risk. The report puts the link between drinking alcohol and developing 7 different types of cancer, including esophagus, breast, liver, and colorectal, in the spotlight to increase awareness. The report also calls for adding information about cancer risk to warning labels on alcohol. And it recommends health professionals discuss the risk, which generally increases the more one drinks, with patients and the public. That way, people can take the risk into account in choosing whether or how much to drink. Here's an overview of what scientists know about the association between alcohol and cancer, and what they still need to learn. The World Health Organization's International Agency for Research on Cancer first classified alcoholic beverages as carcinogenic in 1988. That designation is based on studies finding an association between drinking alcohol and 7 types of cancer: mouth, throat, voice box, esophagus, breast, liver, and colorectal. Researchers have identified the association through observational studies, which compares groups of people in the real world rather than a controlled setting. Generally, the observational studies compare different groups of people over time in terms of the amount they drink and their health. Such studies need to account for other factors that can contribute to cancer risk, such as smoking and age. The association persists for drinking alcohol even after considering those factors and other health behaviors, says Elisa Bandera, a cancer epidemiologist at the Rutgers Cancer Institute in New Brunswick, New Jersey. One challenge with these types of studies is getting accurate information about drinking patterns, including binge drinking and lifetime consumption of alcohol, Bandera says. The studies tend to rely on self-reporting. Because alcohol may be perceived as an unhealthy behavior by some, there is potential for under-reporting the actual amount consumed, leading to potential inaccuracies in the data, she says. Some analyses combine data from multiple studies to report estimates of how many cases of cancer are tied to drinking alcohol. For example, alcohol contributed to an estimated 54,000 cancer cases in women and 42,000 in men in the U.S. in 2019, researchers reported in CA, a cancer journal for clinicians, in 2024. An estimated 741,000, that's about 4%, of all new cancer cases worldwide were attributable to alcohol in 2020, some of the same researchers reported in the journal Lancet Oncology in 2021. Most of those cases were cancers of the esophagus, liver, and breast. The vast majority of the total of new cancer cases were tied to drinking the equivalent of two or more drinks per day. Another analysis that combined 572 studies and more than 486,000 cases of cancer looked at the relative risk of developing cancer. Overall, the risk increased with heavier drinking. Developing cancer in the esophagus, for example, is about 1.3 times as likely with light drinking, which the study defined as less than one drink per day on average, than with not drinking. That grows to nearly 5 times as likely with heavy drinking, defined as more than 4 drinks per day, compared with not drinking. Esophagus cancer is at the high end of the relative risk spectrum. For female breast cancer, the risk was slightly elevated with light drinking and about 1.6 times as likely for heavy drinking compared with not drinking, researchers reported in the British Journal of Cancer in 2014. Scientists are still working out how alcohol can contribute to cancer risk. They have a few theories. With the help of enzymes, the body breaks down alcohol into acetaldehyde. This chemical can damage DNA, which may lead to unchecked cell growth. The process of breaking down alcohol can also lead to the formation of molecules called reactive oxygen species, which can increase inflammation and harm DNA. Some research has suggested that drinking alcohol is associated with increased levels of estrogen, which could help explain the link between alcohol and breast cancer risk. More research is needed on how alcohol contributes to cancer development, says Joy Freudenheim, a cancer epidemiologist at the University at Buffalo in New York. That's especially true for the effect of light to moderate drinking, she says. Studies on the association between drinking and cancer risk tend to discuss the risk in terms of the amount of alcohol per day on average. So an average of 7 drinks per week could mean 1 drink per day or 3 to 4 drinks on each of 2 days. The second pattern probably has a different biological impact than the first does, Freudenheim says. But we need more information about that. Overall, the data suggest that any alcohol consumption increases cancer risk to some extent, Freudenheim says. I think it's important for people to know what their risks are. That means they can look at the data and decide, I am willing to take on this amount of risk, she says. Freudenheim finds Canada's guidance on alcohol and health useful in that regard. It discusses the risk of cancer and other health harms based on the number of drinks a person has per week. And this What Science Says About Alcohol's Link to Cancer report in the Department of Health and Medicine appears in the 2025 Science News issue for February. And the news featured in Materials Science in this same issue of Science News. Record-thin pasta could dress wounds by Skylar Ware. The new record holder for world's thinnest pasta may not be destined for the dinner table. A new starchy fiber made from bleached flour averages 370 nanometers thick, about 200 times as thin as a human hair. The fiber could be used in biodegradable bandages, scientists reported in Nanoscale Advances. Chemist Adam Clancy of University College London and colleagues made a dough by mixing formic acid into flour, which uncoiled the flour's starch molecules. Warming the dough made it suitable for pulling through a needle and onto a plate using an electric charge. The molecules tangled with each other as they left the needle, forming a continuous jet. As the jet flew through the air and onto the plate, the acid evaporated, resulting in a fiber that, after about 30 minutes, formed a mat. Starchy nanofiber mats typically have pores that are too small for bacteria to enter, making them attractive options for bandages, the team says. Since the fiber is flour-based, it qualifies as pasta. That makes it the thinnest on record, a thousandth the width of Sue Filin de You, a pasta about half the width of angel hair that's exclusively handmade by just one family in Italy. But is the new nano pasta edible? I certainly hope so, Clancy says. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.